But as we begin our program, I'm very happy to welcome back to our program, after a long absence, Doug Henwood, a journalist and financial analyst who publishes two newsletters, Left Business Observer and the Lissio Report. Doug is the host of the nationally syndicated radio show Behind the News and is the author of several books, including The State of USA Atlas, Wall Street, and After the New Economy. Doug Henwood's new book is titled My Turn, Hillary Clinton Targets the White House, published by OR Books. Doug, it's great to have you on the program tonight. Thank you so much.
Oh, good to be back.
So I initially wanted to have you here this evening to talk about an important article you just wrote titled New York Times Rounds Up Left-Leaning Economists for a Unicorn Hunt, that was published on the FAIR.org website, Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting's website, which critiques a recent New York Times piece titled Left-Leaning Economists Question Cost of Bernie Sanders' Plans, and citing several economists. But we want to make time this evening to talk about your new book for a bit, because we're going to be offering it to listeners tonight during the first day of our fund drive here on WPKN. But as we get into this article first, I wondered if you'd review for our listeners some of the major points you made in this piece that critiques the whole thrust of the New York Times article that seems focused on undermining Bernie Sanders' idea to move the country to a single-payer universal health care plan that every other industrial nation in the world has put in place.
Yeah, well, the Times play this neat little trick of framing all these economists that they quoted, and there are, I don't know, about four maybe, in the piece, as being left-leaning in some sense. And I suppose they're left-leaning compared to Marco Rubio, but that's about it. They're mostly people with long ties to the Democratic Party, or the centrist wing of the Democratic Party, the business-friendly wing of the Democratic Party, and specifically to Bill and Hillary Clinton. So these were, also the Obama administration. So these are people who are pretty much creatures of and perfectly happy with the status quo. And the most prominently quoted one in it is Austin Goolsbee, who is a very market-friendly kind of guy, teaches now at the University of Chicago Business School, said very famously during the 2008 campaign to some Canadians that they shouldn't listen to Obama's campaign talk against NAFTA because it was just for, you know, political consumption. He didn't really mean it. And, of course, he didn't really mean it. But, you know, that's the kind of guy that Goolsbee is, a very free trade, Wall Street-friendly guy. And his critique, and then he cites Paul Krugman, who's been taking this line, Ezra Klein at Vox also, that Bernie Sanders is promising people, like, ponies and unicorns and, you know, rainbows, and it's just all this magical stuff, as if a single-payer health plan is so unreal, as if it's so surreal and fanciful, as if it didn't actually promise to cover more people and actually save money, if it be like it would be anywhere else in the world. They just evoked all these mocking metaphors, like the unicorns and the puppies and the rainbows in the sky, without offering any really serious analysis of what it's about. And then they also cited a paper by a health economist named Kenneth Thorpe, who, oddly enough, in two earlier papers back in the earlier 2000s, supported a single-payer plan and said it would save lots of money and cover everyone. He did one study for the state of Missouri and another for a foundation that was pushing a single-payer scheme. But this time around, he's against it. This is a guy who was in the Bill Clinton administration running some of his health care proposals. Here's a partisan guy with interests in the Clinton camp who's contradicting his own history with his latest analysis. All very mysterious, but the reporter didn't bother to cite any of the actual serious critique of Thorpe's paper provided by the marvelous David Himmelstein and Steffi Woolhandler, co-founders of Physicians for a National Health Program, pointed out any number of flaws in the Thorpe paper, but they were just alluded to in passing, but not actually cited in the articles. It was just read really like an opinion piece disguised as a news story, an opinion piece that was designed to mock Sanders and make Clinton look really reasonable. It's amazing to watch the Clinton campaign through the candidate herself and her surrogates systematically campaign on lowering expectations and telling people they can't have stuff. It's just a remarkable display that I suppose it's seen as mature to tell people they can't have things, but you know, God knows we can have things. And why run on a basis of saying we can't?
Yeah, no, that's a perfectly important critique of this piece. Now, you also mentioned that Ezra Klein, who's quoted in this New York Times article, was himself a booster of single-payer health plans. In fact, you point out that the other economists quoted in this New York Times article, Paul Krugman, used an article written by Ezra Klein of Vox and often appears as a guest on MSNBC, a piece that written several years ago that is in full support of single-payer health care that Krugman included it in his syllabus where he taught at Princeton, I believe.
Yeah, my friend Seth Ackerman read a piece for Jacobin, posted on their website, that reviewed the history of Klein and his partner at Vox, Matt Iglesias, both of whom used to support single-payer schemes. But now that Hillary is against them and Bernie is for them, suddenly they're against single-payer schemes. Klein, in particular, made his reputation when he was, I think, 23 or 24 years old, precocious little fellow, made a reputation on a piece he published in the American Prospect in 2007 that was very pro-single-payer, reviewed what he called the best healthcare systems in the world, citing France, Germany, and Canada, all very approvingly, and said we could learn from them. But now that we have somebody actually running for office with a serious candidacy, perhaps not as serious as it was a week ago, but still a candidacy that's really shaken up the political scene. Now that there's actually somebody out there stumping for it, suddenly Klein is against it. And Krugman himself used to be a pro-single-payer fellow. But all these guys say, for some reason, that by pushing for single-payer, we're somehow opening up Obamacare to, as they say, relitigating. And I don't understand why they love that turn of phrase, but that's what they say. We don't want to relitigate Obamacare. But you know, I don't understand how the politics of how asking for something that's better will lead to something worse. But there's this consensus among a certain kind of centrist to moderately liberal Democrat now that the right is so powerful and so dominant that all we can do is fight defensive battles and hope to preserve what remaining aspects of a welfare state that we have, and that it's wrong to push for more. It's wrong to be ambitious and idealistic because everything is just so hopeless and so vulnerable. I also don't get the politics of that. You know, that's not the way the right rose to power in America, by making minimalist demands and lowering its expectations. I was on the right in the early 1970s, and we were very unusual. We were very besieged. We were very marginal, but we had a core set of beliefs and fought for them. And I don't see that seems to be the best kinds of politics to practice. Have a set of beliefs that you really hold dearly and fight for them hard. And that's the kind of thing that changes the world. Not this timid defensive posture that Krugman et al. Always seem to assume.
Well, what's fascinating to me is the fact that you have all these successfully run single-payer healthcare systems all across the world in major nations that have operated them for many decades after World War II. And it's almost like somebody saying solar power doesn't work when you have examples of solar power working every place. But, here are these folks denying that this fact of life all over the world just can't possibly work in the United States. I know there's the term or phrase that the exceptionalism of the United States, but I don't think that applies to the fact that we cannot implement single payer in the United States.
Well, now we have Medicare, which works very, very well. It was introduced in, I think, 1965, in less than a year. We had very primitive computers back then, and we somehow managed to enroll almost the entire over 65 population in less than a year and get the thing running and paying bills. There's just no reason why it could not be done. The obstacles are all political. And this idea that somehow single payer is budget busting is really, really devious. It means that what we now spend on private health care, which is, I don't know, something like in the order of 8 or 9% of GDP, we'd shift some of that into the public sector, but we wouldn't be spending it on private insurance premiums anymore. It's not an increase in spending. It is a shift of private spending to a far more efficient public sector spending. The administrative costs of our private health care system are enormous, hundreds of billions of dollars a year, and that would disappear under a single-payer system. Of course, so would the profits of insurance companies, and also other countries with single-payer systems. There are other ways of organizing besides a Canadian-style single-payer. In Britain, the provision of medical care is also socialized. The hospitals and doctors work for the state. They don't. In the Canadian system, you have private hospitals and private doctors, and the payment system is what the government runs. So there are different ways of going about it. The British system is extremely efficient. They spend a little over half as much as a share of GDP on health care as we do. Canada spends about a third less than we do. Yet both systems cover the entire population. Even after Obamacare, we're still like about 10% of the American population is not covered by health insurance still. So we have this examples from many countries around the world, including Canada, which is very similar to us in very many ways. It's only a little ways away from the United States. They managed to do it very efficiently and provide universal coverage, and people don't go bankrupt. People don't die from lack of basic health care, which is the sort of thing that happens here all the time. Yeah, they're perfectly functioning examples, but somehow there's this perverse version of American exceptionalism that says we just can't do anything, and that's humane and efficient because we're Americans.
Well, Doug, I wanted to ask you, as a longtime observer of the New York Times, and I think the belief of many, which may be mistaken, that there's a firewall between editorial and journalism at the New York Times. How often do we see hit pieces like this, which seem blatantly politically driven in favor of Hillary Clinton as the Democratic Party nominee as opposed to Bernie Sanders? How often do we see that kind of leech over from the editorial pages to the journalistic pieces you read in the newspaper?
Well, pretty often, as far as the Sanders campaign goes. Now, the person who was the major reporter on the Hillary beat for a long time, Amy Chozick, started out, it seemed to me, very sympathetic to her. She's gotten more critical lately, which is a good thing to see. But they had a piece, I don't know, about a month ago by Nick Confessore. I don't know if he pronounces that in the Italian fashion or if he Americanizes it. But he was trying to claim that there were more PACs spending money on Bernie Sanders than there were on any other candidate. What he was referring to was the National Nurses Union spent about $1 million on Sanders, but he was trying to make it sound like some sinister pool of dark money operating in Sanders' behalf. And in the course of writing this article, he didn't mention the groups like Correct the Record and all the David Brock front groups that have been spending scores of millions on Hillary. Independently of her campaign, but definitely on her behalf. So he twisted the thing enormously to make it look like somehow Sanders was the beneficiary of this sinister dark money and Hillary was just, innocent of all that. That was an egregious example. But a lot of their coverage is certainly spun in favor of Hillary. And just the amount of attention, and this is true of all the media, really, the amount of attention that they pay to Trump compared to the amount of attention they pay to Sanders, it's like I'm not exaggerating, I think it's like 100-to-1 ratio on the TV. It's not quite that bad in the Times, but still, Trump, every time he opens his mouth, he gets an enormous amount of coverage, and Sanders can't really get any except this kind of critical coverage. Yes, and then was it Today's Times? There's a story about how they're pretty much announcing it all over for Sanders, his steep hill to climb and for amassing delegates to win the nomination. We've had a couple of primaries and a couple of caucuses. I mean, it's really pretty early to declare the nomination Hillary's, but this has been the thinking all along. It's all hers. I mean, she was the all but certain nominee starting last year, and now she's the all but, well, she for a while seemed like the all but certain president, but that now seems somewhat more troubled than it was. But the assumption that was just all about her has been pervasive in the Times and the rest of the American media and among the pundit class.
Thanks for that, Doug. We're speaking with Doug Henwood, a journalist and financial analyst who publishes two newsletters, Left Business Observer and the Lissio Report. And Doug's newest book is titled My Turn, Hillary Clinton Targets the White House, with a very provocative cover that we'll mention here in a moment. But we'll be offering copies of Doug's book this evening during the first day of our early spring fun drive here on this listener-sponsored station. We'll give you more information about that in a moment. But Doug, wanted to have you summarize this book, which, you know, as opposed to a right-wing critique of Hillary Clinton that has certainly been in the press in all of our media for 25 years or so, your book really takes Hillary Clinton to task, you know, with a left critique of her politics over these many years. But summarize for our listeners really what your mission was in this book.
Well, there are several aspects of my critique. One is I think people don't really appreciate how conservative a streak she has. She, going back to her days in Arkansas, when she was the first lady of Arkansas, she led a campaign against the teachers union there. One of the first examples of politicians running against teachers unions and supervising administration of a competency test to teachers, who, by the way, were disproportionately black women. And so they were the targets of this campaign. She was also, while she was first lady, she was a lawyer at the Rose Law Firm, which was the most elite law firm in Arkansas with clients like Walmart and Tyson Foods. She served on the Walmart board. Said absolutely nothing about their systematic sex discrimination and anti-union policies, and actually praised the company at an annual meeting. She, going on to her career as first lady, she botched the health care reform that Bill entrusted her with, and then went on to just a bunch of little initiatives, this and that, but nothing of substance. She supported her husband's crime bill, the 1994 crime bill, and the end of welfare. She supported both those things quite volubly, quite aggressively. She gave a speech in which she said it was time to bring the super predator youth to heel. It was really just a racist, paranoid depiction of black youth as super predators. She was really up there at the worst of the right, stoking fear of crime. She had referred to welfare recipients as deadbeats, so when with welfare reform they're able to become productive members of society. She defended the welfare reform as late as 2002 or 2003 in one of her long, unreadable memoirs. And then as senator, she voted for the Iraq War and actually talked up connections between al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein, which didn't exist. No other Democrat, not even Joe Lieberman, bought that line. Only the Bush administration, the hardline neocons, bought that line. Then, you know, she wanted to become Secretary of State, where she helped enable the success of the coup in Honduras against an elected leftish president. She did terrible things with the reconstruction of Haiti after the earthquake, just allowed lots of American companies to make some money while providing absolutely nothing for Haitians. It was a disgraceful performance. She was often, even though she's the nation's top diplomat, she's often the most bellicose member of Obama's cabinet, outdoing even Defense Secretary Robert Gates, a Republican, in her aggressiveness. She promoted fracking around the world. She helped break U.S. oil companies into the Mexican market. She had a list of companies. Whenever she would travel, she had a list of American companies whose business she would promote as Secretary of State. And then she left. When she left the Secretary of State position, she started criticizing Obama for not arming the Syrian rebels early enough. You know, she's a big supporter of the toppling of Gaddafi, and this has just been created. Gaddafi's a horrible person, but you know, toppling him the way they did created nothing but disaster and chaos in Libya. So you know, she's. Of dubious competence, very bellicose, with a deep conservative streak in a lot of ways. Also, quite a moralist too. She was like worked with Tipper Gore in her campaign against dirty rap lyrics. So she's far more conservative than most people realize, and also extremely dishonest. She just takes. She has a very hard time with the truth. From things like you know that story that she landed in Bosnia under sniper fire, which is not true, to saying that she was born, it was named after Sir Edmund Hillary, even though he climbed Mount Everest 5 years after she was born, to big things like you know all the scandals of the Clinton years, I don't even want to get into Whitewater, but you know, there actually is a little smelly stuff there. And now with the email server, the email scandal, as Secretary of State, she was trying to prevent any kind of public scrutiny of her correspondence. And I don't think it was just an oversight. She knew exactly what she's doing. She has a long history of being secretive and duplicitous. And you know, we have enough government secrecy right now. The last thing we need is somebody who's temperamentally even more secretive and duplicitous than your average politician. So politically and personally, I think she's far worse news than a lot of people realize.
Well, it's, you know, if the prognosticators are correct, she may be headed towards the nomination. Doug, and we'll plan to have you back soon to talk, give a little bit more time than we have had right now this evening. But our listeners got a taste of what they can find in this book, a reality check on who Hillary Clinton is and who she isn't. We'll look forward to finding new homes for your book tonight among our listeners. Doug, it's great to have you back here, and we'll get in touch soon to book another date so we can have you back to talk about the book.
Thanks, Scott. I gather you're fundraising now, and I do that on my own radio show for KPFA, and I just mm-hmm. want to say support community radio like WPKN. It's a precious resource in this country, and we're in terrible shape without it, so people pick up the phone and support this great enterprise because you know, we'd be much the poorer without radio stations like WPKN.
Appreciate that thought and your help tonight with the book. Appreciate that, Doug. Take care.
Thank you. Bye.
We'll talk soon. Bye-bye. That's Doug Henwist, journalist and author. His newest book is titled My Turn, Hillary Clinton Targets the White House.